Good morning and welcome to Jump in Tucson on this wonderful Monday morning. I'm your host, Dr. Ed Ackerley, and our producer is Matt Neely. In the studio with me is my brother, William Ackerley. Coming up tomorrow, General Ted Maxwell will be the host. On Wednesday, Lydia Randa will be sitting in for Grant Kruger, who will be off in Washington, D.C. And Thursday, Tom Moulton will be in with visitors and attractions and so forth. I'll return on Friday, next Friday, with this coming Friday, with business success stories. And so, you know, the Wonder Series at the University of Arizona, we highlight the good things that are going on. I often say there's been a lot of news lately about interesting things going on that kind of get the headlines, and lots of people talking about things going on at the U of A with personnel and situations and finances and so forth. And so it's sometimes we miss some of the good things that are going on at the U of A. So this show on Mondays is about the wonder, about the good things that are happening at the University of Arizona. And one of those things that's happening is, that has been happening for years, is the medical school that we have, but the really good care that's being taken and the teaching that's going on to young people and folks who are getting degrees in all sorts of things, but including pharmacy and helping people with that area of healthcare. And with us today is the dean of the School of Pharmacy, Rick Schnellman, Dr. Rick Schnellman. And good morning and welcome to you.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit first about you. And, you know, you're the dean. To become a dean of a department or a school and a large Division I research institution, a land-grant university like the U of A, with a huge presence in the medical area and so forth, it's a big deal. It's a big deal to be a dean of an academic unit and of a teaching area like that. How'd you get there? How'd you get from pharmacy to becoming the dean of the school itself?
It was a long saga,
right?
I would say. And so I got my BS in pharmacy. That was a long time ago,
mm-hmm.
right? So it was a 5-year program, and that was in 1980.
Right.
And so that was an interest.
Mm-hmm.
To be honest with you, though, I had no really intention to be a pharmacist.
Mm-hmm.
The goal was here is to go to pharmacy school so I could get in to do research,
mm-hmm.
and that's what I did. And so after I finished up in pharmacy school, guess where I came? University of Arizona.
Right. Do some research. You wanted to do
research.
That? Yeah, research, yeah.
And the program here at that time, my PhDs in pharmacology and toxicology, was just amazing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the faculty were good. My peers were good. They cared about being good mentors.
Right.
And so when I left here, I thought I got a great education.
Right.
Right. So I left that. And then you have to sort of do a fellowship, and I did that, and that was at Duke for a couple of years. And then at that point, I got an assistant professorship, and I can give you a whole long list of
right.
that. But anyway, after the first assistantship, right, you have to go over the years, right, and rise from assistant to associate, and associate to full professor.
Mm-hmm.
And that took a number of years to do that type of thing. And then I took a job as a department chair at the Medical University of South Carolina College of Pharmacy. And I was there for a while. So that was sort of research and administrative, as you know, as departments mm-hmm. are. Being a dean was never on my list.
Right, right.
it was never on my list.
Right.
But I was tired of being a department chair.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, there's not a whole lot of different kinds of jobs in academia.
Mm-hmm.
So at that time, and that was about 2016, the previous dean left, and I got a call saying, you're an alum.
Right.
You know, and why don't you take a look at us? And so obviously it was already in my heart,
right?
Because I had such a good experience the first time around. I'm thinking, hey, I don't know if I want to be a dean, but, you know, it's a place where I would really like to be.
Right. Right.
And so I did it, and it's been 7.5 years now.
Wow. Wow. Fantastic. You know, I'm looking at your credits here. You know, you're the Howard J. Schaefer Endowed Chair. You're a professor in pharmacology and toxicology. You're a professor in medicine and physiology, the College of Medicine and the College of Pharmacy. That's a stacks up to a pretty powerful academic and teaching and administrative career. We're well served to have you here at the U of A leading the College of Pharmacy. It's been a great journey for you, and it's great to have you here in Tucson doing that. And you can't be, even though Duke was probably pretty good, we have a pretty good basketball team too, so that's a good thing.
I agree.
Yeah. Well, how many students are in the school, and how many people are being trained in pharmacology and toxicology and all that that you work with? Is it a fairly large deployment?
So the College of Pharmacy, it's the Coit College of Pharmacy
right
now.
Obviously. Right. Yeah, obviously we're going to talk about that. Right?
The College of Pharmacy is what you call a small college.
Right.
Things like nursing, public health, not Eller.
Right.
That is not a small college.
Right, it's a big college.
So it is a small college, right? And so the total number of students we have in the college is about 1,000.
Right, that's pretty big though, yeah.
And 500 500 of those are getting a PharmD degree, and then go out and be a pharmacist.
Right.
And then there's 400 of them, which is an undergraduate program called the Bachelor of Science in Pharmaceutical Sciences.
Mm-hmm.
And we created that. Now, it sounds like exactly that. Okay, you're just getting prepared to get into the PharmD, but that was never our intent.
Right.
The thing is that we have created this BSPS program such that if you want to go to medical school, dental school, veterinary school, or pharmacy school, we'll give you a really good place to jump off from, because during those years, you're going to see a lot of you'll see a lot of pharmacology, toxicology, and pharmacy.
Right.
So that's what we did, and it's been quite successful.
That's great. Well, that's an interesting approach, and to have, you know, we did that with law, too. We have that undergraduate program in law for kind of that same springboard to getting people into the major as they move through the process. And so having 1,000 students is, you know, that's not insignificant, especially when we're talking about pharmacy and keeping people well, getting them well, and using all the resources for that. When we come back, we'll talk about this donation and the COIT, calling it now the COIT school. And we'll talk about that in just a minute. You're listening to Jump in Tucson on KVOI 1030 AM. We're talking with Dr. Rick Snellman, Dean of the COIT College of Pharmacy. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back on this Monday morning to Jump in Tucson. This is Dr. Ed Ackerley. Our guest this Monday morning is Dr. Rick Snellman. He is the Dean of the Coit College of Pharmacy at the University of Arizona. You know, and Mondays we talk about the good things going on, the Wonder Series, talking about the good things going on at the U of A. You know, before we talk about the donation that we got, the school got for the College of Pharmacy, I was telling you the story about I had one of our former deans at the Elder College. We were doing a going away party, and he pulled me outside, and we were talking about some other things. And he said, you know, when I became the dean, I didn't know that I'd have to kind of give up teaching students, which he loved, and giving up the research, which obviously, as you said, one of the reasons you get involved in these things is to try and do the research to, you know, solve all the world's problems. We're going to go do this research. But when you become a dean, there's so much administrative work going on and so many answering to so many constituents and traveling around trying to raise money and so forth. It's a daunting task. So how do you handle teaching and research and the passions that you have, as well as being an administrative academic administrator?
Not easy, first of all. And so I've looked back and say, where do I spend my time? So I spend around 30% of my time raising money.
30%, that's not too bad, yeah.
Yeah.
That's better than 100%, yeah.
Completely. Yeah. And then I would say management, administrative stuff, maybe 40%, 50%, somewhere in that range. But I do research yet.
You still get to do research.
I do. In fact, it's a requirement. Otherwise, I wouldn't have taken a job.
Mm-hmm.
Because
that's your passion.
That's the passion.
Right. And being able to do that then also keeps the job interesting and keeps it, you know, if you weren't doing that, you would kind of be in that administrative lull of just consistently raising money and doing the administrative side of things, which is important work. That's really important leadership work. But the passion comes from doing the research.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so when it's when administration is starting to overwhelm you, I just go to the lab for a little while.
I love it. I love it. That's great. You know, you know Ken and Donna Coit, because I'm looking at you here with a picture of them out in front of the Coit College of Pharmacy. Tell us a little bit about them, and then we'll talk about the gift that they gave to the college. And what was his career, and how did they become benefactors of the college?
So Ken is an alum and in pharmacy from the college. I think he practiced pharmacy maybe a couple years, and he decided that's not what he wanted to do.
Right.
And so he got into business, and then has been there ever since. And he has a big business with apartments and things like that. Mm-hmm. And he controls all of that. And,
right.
He's been very successful.
Yeah. And he decided that the success that he and his wife have enjoyed, that they wanted to give a legacy. And so they came to the college, and you guys worked out a deal, and they recently donated the recent tranche, there'll probably be more, $5 million that they gave to the College of Pharmacy. Tell us about what you're going to do with that money, and obviously the naming of the Ken Coit College of Pharmacy. So tell us a little bit about how that all came about, and what the not the restrictions, but what the target it is for that $5 million.
Sure. For the $5 million or for the naming?
Well,
the naming came first.
The naming came first, and then, as I said, there's going to be tranches of money that comes that go reach out to faculty and so forth. Yeah.
So I met Ken. He was on college's National Advisory Board.
Oh, uh-huh.
And I met him. And got to know him because there's meetings, as you know, all the time.
Right.
And he was very generous at that point. But he came to me one day and said, I think I'm ready to give a big gift.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't even have to ask.
That's awesome. That makes it easier when you're the chief fundraiser. It's nice when they come to you. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, but that takes time, as you know.
Yeah.
And
relationships.
So,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. And we negotiated about 18 months, I guess, to figure out what it all would look like, because then you got to codify everything.
Mm-hmm.
He gave $50 million.
Right.
And so that's...
That's how you get your name on a building or name on a college, is to give a significant amount of money. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What he asked for, you know, what is the big thing is? And so after a bunch of conversations, and then he says, okay, you know, I said, you got to give me sort of what general things you like to fund.
Right.
And he says, well, definitely I need to get scholarships.
Mm-hmm.
And
help the students, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And he said that. And
especially in underserved populations and people that maybe couldn't afford to come to become a pharmacist. Yeah, really important.
And what was in that thing as well, he said, I want you to use some of it for people for need,
mm-hmm.
right? He said that I also want a part of it to get great students.
Right.
What else would anybody want?
That's fantastic.
Right. Yeah. So that was what he wanted to do.
Right.
So then he went to the next thing is, and he says, well, our college rank's pretty good, but we need to get it up there. We need to get it up in the top five. He says, how can you do that? And I said, well, I know how to do that. I said, but it's...
need a little bit of money to do that. Yeah.
And so what he did, he gave us $20 million in cash.
Right.
Right.
That point.
Mm-hmm. To make that change. And the fastest way to increase your ranking in academia is increase the amount of research you do. And you can do that by hiring endowed chairs.
Right.
And that's exactly what we've done.
Right. And you've taken, and then he gives another $5 million. And as I said, tranches are coming in. And who knows, what the future will bring and what he, but mm-hmm. the interesting thing about like when Mr. Coit gives money from his, it does draw other money too, and other people see what's happening mm-hmm. and they want to do the same thing that he is, elevating the college and elevating the faculty to endowed chairs. And again, getting the best students we possibly can in Tucson to work right. on pharmacology and toxicology and those kind of things. So it's a good marriage, if you will.
Yes.
And he's engaged in the process because he's mentoring, trying to say, what else can I do? What else can I do? What else can I do?
Yeah. I call Ken, or we talk every other week.
That's great. So he is really involved in the process then.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
And it's part of, we have this program through the foundation. It's called Fuel Wonder. It's all about continuing with trying to endow, but also just to you know, as we all know, academia and university life is very expensive to, you know, when you think about the number of employees that the U of A has and the amount of infrastructure and the several billions of dollars worth of budget that goes through the process every year. Sustaining that for 50, 60, 100, 200 years is a commitment, and it's great to have benefactors like the Coits coming through. So let's talk specifically about getting endowed chairs and hiring faculty. So you're out looking around the country to see if there's some alumni and some other people that might fit the bill, huh?
So he gave us 6 endowed right. chairs. We've already filled them with 5.
Great. Where do I apply? I don't know anything about. I know what an aspirin is. That's about all I know. So
yeah, it's going to take a little more.
I take more than that. Okay.
Yeah. but we've been very successful, and on that side, it's the research. Obviously, is important thing is, but Ken likes numbers. That
right.
is, what is your ranking?
Mm.
So I can happy to say now where we were was number 8 years ago, around 40 ranking.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm happy to tell you, we're 4.
Number 4. Wow.
Number 4 in the
Congratulations
country.
To you.
I know. I'm thrilled.
Yeah. And you take all the credit for that. I want you to take all the credit for that because... now, the 40 you don't take credit for, but you take credit for when you move to 4. That's pretty impressive. So.
Yeah. But, you know, I've hired many
yeah.
people that are just outstanding. That right. at their top of what they, you know what I mean, at the very top of the cream.
Right, right.
Right? Hire them because they're the ones that they are doing it now and can do it further.
Right. Do some of those faculty people, they're obviously still doing research as well as teaching and...
That is the whole part.
They want to be doing the research.
Research.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. And does that attract, obviously, grants and that type of stuff? So as you move up the ladder from 40 to 4th, that also attracts not only more... faculty that are in that range, but also it attracts more funding from
right.
from the outside and private funds and grants and federal grants and so forth to help you to fund that research, which is the lifeblood of what you're doing. So that's great. Well, this is fantastic, and congratulations to you on the rise of the program over the last under your leadership, and hopefully you'll stick around for a while and keep that going, and while you continue to do your research and teach the students as you can. So we've been speaking with Dr. Rick Snellman. He is the dean of the Coit College of, it's the R. Coit College of Pharmacy at the University of Arizona, a really important part of the University of Arizona, and that's fantastic, and we're glad that the Coits are continuing to endow faculty and help students who need it, and the good work that you're able to do, and that percentage of time that you get to spend on your research is really, really rewarding, I assume it's really rewarding. That's great. Well, one question I did want to ask is do we have a reach out program to students here at the in the Valley of Tucson to come to the College of Pharmacy? Are you have a robust trying to get people who might like you, you know, didn't ever thought you'd be a pharmacist, but it's something to think about.
I have one particular person mm-hmm. who does all of marketing and she is just amazing.
Great, great. So you're reaching out to students who may not think about that as a career, and all of a sudden they might right. have an opportunity to look at that.
So and great. We look across the state as well.
Yeah.
I mean, we have people up in Phoenix.
That's great. Well, thank you for being here today, Dr. Rick Schnellman, Dean of the Arcoit College of Pharmacy at the University of Arizona, on Jump In Tucson on this Wonder Monday, talking about the good things at the University of Arizona. And this is certainly one of those great things that's happening. So thanks for being with us today.
Glad to be here.
All right. You're listening to Jump In Tucson on KVOI Radio. Welcome back to this Monday. Guess what today is? Today is tax day. So if you haven't filled out your tax forms and sent them in, or send in an extension to the IRS, make sure that you do that. I think Bill and I have done the extension every year for the last decade, if I'm not mistaken. It just seems like it's overwhelming to try and get that information together. Hey, this is the Wonder Series of Jump In Tucson, the Monday version, where we talk about the good things going on at the University of Arizona. With us for this segment is my good friend Sixto Molina. Good morning, Sixto.
Good morning, Dr. Eckerly. How are you?
How'd you play yesterday on the course on Sunday? Were you did you have a good golf game? Yeah, I know you played on Thursday, but did you play on Sunday? Where'd you play yesterday?
Yes, I played at Del Urich, shot 76, which is a good score, but not good enough to win.
There you go. Well, today we're talking about something very unique. It's just it was when I saw the note, how the moon turned itself inside out, it just kind of amazed me. And so with us to talk about this is the newly minted Dr. Weiging Liang. So congratulations on your doctorate and getting that at the University of Arizona. Let's talk first, before we get into that interesting discussion about the moon, which is quite appropriate since last week we had the eclipse and everybody was looking at the moon. That was great, by the way. Bill went to Dallas to see the eclipse and saw the totality of it. And I went down to Flandreau and watched it. It was amazing. It was an incredible experience. So let's talk a little bit about you and how you got to the University of Arizona, where you're from, and how you got to the University of Arizona.
Yeah. So hi, everyone. I'm Weiging. And I was born pretty close to Hong Kong, and then came to the U.S. at around age 10. Mm-hmm. Went to a school called Boston Latin School, where we learn Latin.
Mm. And what is God's phone number? Ecum Spiritu Tuo?
Something like that.
Yeah.
And then went to Cornell to get my bachelor in physics.
Physics.
Mm-hmm. And where I started my research journey working with Dr. Alex Hayes on images from the Martian rovers.
Mm-hmm.
And then I came to the University of Arizona to pursue a doctorate in planetary sciences, where I managed to figure out that the moon turned itself inside out.
Yeah, you know, Cornell is a great place. Matter of fact, coming up here in 2 days, John Gordon's going to be with my students at the Eller College, and he's from Cornell. He went to Cornell. He wrote the book, The Energy Bus, and He's great. But one of my other heroes from Cornell, besides you, is Carl Sagan, who I was fascinated in the 70s and 80s with his book, The Cosmos, but just his making astronomy and astrophysics just something palatable that a person that didn't know anything about it to understand all that interesting stuff. So Cornell's a great birthing ground for lots of astrophysicists and astronomers and so forth. So planetary sciences at the U of A, why did you pick planetary sciences? Why didn't you pick some other, why was that interesting to you?
So as a child, I was really fascinated by both just seeing the stars in the sky, the planets, Venus, mm-hmm. Mars, and also the various achievements that the space agencies around the world had done.
Right.
The moon landing, missions to the outer planets, Neptune, Uranus. And so that's pretty early on, I would say, I decided I wanted to at least pursue planetary science and see how far I can get.
Mm-hmm.
And the department here at the U of A has a really rich history in planetary sciences, as well as many scientists from the U of A have gone to great careers in NASA and beyond. Mm-hmm. And so
I think it's a unique trivia contest. If you're ever having a after golf, this is a good one for you, Sixto. If you're ever having an after game trivia contest in the 19th hole, lying about your scores and how great you did, you could ask this question: what university in the world is the only university that has been involved in every major NASA program since its inception? And the answer is the University of Arizona. As a matter of fact, if I'm not mistaken, Dr. Lang, didn't the University of Arizona help map the backside of the moon? That, you know, we can't see it because it's facing us the same way all the time, but wasn't the University of Arizona instrumental in helping map the backside of the moon?
Yeah, the University of Arizona basically wrote the encyclopedia for all of the planets in the solar system from the 1960s, and they're still used now, so...
All right. I have to tell you a little side story. You know, I happen to be Roman Catholic, and I had a teacher at the university. I took astronomy in the 70s, and I had a teacher by the name of Dr. George Coyne, and he was teaching this astronomy class. It was fascinating, and one little example he gave was, you know, as the stars and the planets are all moving away from each other, the analogy he used was a chocolate chip cake that you put all the chocolate chips in, and as you cook it, every chocolate chip is moving away from every other chocolate chip, and kind of a, you know, as it expands. And he said that's kind of like the universe. The universe is expanding like this. So I was just fascinated. Well, I found out that he was a Jesuit priest, and he actually ran the Pope's Vatican Observatory in Castel Gandolfo. So when I got to go over there in 79 to study abroad, I got to go down to Castel Gandolfo, and there's this huge book in the Pope's entrance of his house and so forth in Castel Gandolfo. And this was Pope John Paul II when he was first became Pope. Huge book. I mean, I'm talking, you know, thousands of pages. And there's only a few more pages left on this side because all of these people have signed this book and it's been pulled over to the side. I got to sign, or the other way around, I got signed my name on a page that Napoleon had written his name on, and all these kings and so forth. So that's kind of neat. So I too have been fascinated since childhood with astronomy and so forth. So you took that to the University of Arizona, and you became a student and went into the Planetary Sciences side. And what was the focus of your research and your dissertation and so forth? What were you working on when you were there as a student?
My focus was to use gravity data from the moon to uncover the background and history of the moon from about 4 billion years ago to now. And I think gravity is really unique because gravity measures things that we can't see. So on the surface, we can, you know, learn a lot about the moon, but gravity tells us a lot about the structures and the configurations of the subsurface, which are also key in understanding what the moon has gone through those years ago.
It was kind of interesting on this past Monday. Did you see the eclipse? Were you out looking at the eclipse?
Yes.
Yes. Were you standing on a golf course looking at the eclipse?
No, I was at home.
You were at home?
And yeah. I was careful not to, I didn't have the glasses, so I was careful not to look directly at the sun.
And Bill was in Dallas, and he saw about 4 minutes of totality, as they call it. The point I'm making is it's amazing how we take the moon and the sun and the planets for granted and the stars for granted. And then you see something like the eclipse, and it suddenly kind of brings it all into totality, if you will, about how unique the system is that we live in and how gravity has been able to keep these celestial bodies in these orbits since time immemorial. And amazing that gravity has such a powerful, and maybe dark matter, I don't know what else, but what else is keeping those spheres of rock and ice and so forth. So it's amazing what the moon has and what it does for tell us about what the moon does for the Earth. It's a kind of a unique system, isn't it?
Yeah, I believe to our understanding, we haven't found many, I guess, exomoons and exo-Earths that can produce the solar eclipse in the way that we saw it. So it's a really unique system.
Mm-hmm.
And the moon, besides providing sort of a romantic thing to see in the night sky, also is responsible for tides that, you know, if you're a surfer, you'll love.
Yeah. And for romance too.
Yeah.
So, yeah, those full moons. Well, we're talking with Dr. Weging Ling, who is a newly minted doctor from the University of Arizona. We'll come back and we'll talk about a unique research that he did on how the moon turned itself inside out. And we'll talk about that creative title and creative understanding of the moon. You're listening to Jump in Tucson on KVOI 1030. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. This is Ed Ackerley. Monday is the Wonder Series. We celebrate the good things at the University of Arizona. In the studio with me today is my former campaign chair and good friend, Sixto Molina. Good morning, Sixto.
Good morning, Dr. Ed.
Good to see you again. And my brother Bill is here. Our guest, it's funny, you called me Dr. Ed. I sent a couple of emails out to Dr. Wegging, and that's like calling me Dr. Ed. His real name is Dr. Liang. So Dr. Wegging Liang, a brand new doctor from the University of Arizona, graduated last year. Tell us what the title of your dissertation was.
The Vestiges of the Lunar Ilmenite Layer as Revealed by Gravity Data.
Fantastic, fantastic. And that gets right to the topic that, have this great thing, how the moon turned itself inside out. Tell us about the whole prospect of that, of how you came up with turning the moon inside out.
Yeah, so with gravity, we were able to see features that were subsurface that were, you know, almost the length of the continental U.S. from east to west. And with the feature that big, it would be a moment-defining event in lunar history. And so we found that those gravity signatures were from the remnants of when the moon turned itself inside out, where the last rips more or less got stuck on top and remained to this day.
Was that because the moon was molten in the middle and it was going through its metamorphosis of a hot ball of mass that was full of energy and so forth, and through volcanism it was turning itself inside and out, and that's kind of how it all came about?
Exactly. The moon base.
Was that a pretty good layman's description of what? For a guy that doesn't know anything about astronomy, that was a pretty good description, wasn't it? Yeah. So tell us about that, how the whole process worked. And it probably played out over millions of years, right?
Yeah. So the moon basically cooled itself from top and down. And so the liquid that was stuck in the middle that cooled last were actually heavier than the layers that cooled below it. So that created, since heavier things tend to go down into lighter things, that was the reason behind the overturning of the moon. And that, as Dr. Ackley said, took, you know, millions of years, even half a billion years.
Mm-hmm. And was this was a one, I mean, obviously this took place over a long period of time, but it was kind of a one-time occurrence, right? Is the moon still going through this process, or is it pretty stable now, kind of like the Earth, where it's kind of maybe not at the end of that process, but it's kind of stabilized itself?
Yes. So right now we believe that the moon has been stable for roughly 3 billion years.
Mm.
So the period of time in which we believe the moon was most active was from its formation to around 1.5 billion years after its formation.
Are you of the theoretical mind that the moon is a remnant of an exoplanet that bashed into the Earth and then created this celestial body that we know as a companion? So that's the modern theory, and that's kind of what you think happened 4.5 billion years ago, basically? Yeah.
Yes, I think that's one of the leading theories in lunar history, and I think it's pretty exciting, right? And it's, you know, a huge explosion causing the two bodies that we know and love.
And the creativity of that is that the Earth itself was kind of birthing the moon with this collision. Then all of a sudden there's the Earth stayed, and it didn't explode into a billion mini little pieces and go away. It stayed in its larger physical form, and then this other little planet that it wasn't too little, but a little planet that hit the Earth and created this extra collection of dust and particles and everything and pieces and rocks and all sorts of things into the moon and collected into the moon. Pretty unique story, right? There, as you said, there isn't many other systems in the that we know of at this point that have that kind of a system.
Yeah.
But, you know, the larger planets, the gaseous planets and so forth, they have moons, you know, some of them with 23, 42 moons, you know, and captured asteroids and all sorts of things that are flying around, but nothing to this extent of, and the fact that gravity is holding it in place there in between the Earth and the Sun is really an amazing thing. And for so many years, for 3 billion years.
Yeah. I mean, gravity, the nice thing about it is that, as we alluded to before, the solar eclipses, we can really predict from, you know, a long time ago.
But you use history to predict the future too, right? So you look at the trajectory of the moon around the Earth and how it travels and where it is at certain points. And so you can predict what, so you said, what, 45 years now, the next total solar eclipse over Arizona is. I learned something in this too, by the way. You'll love this, that Tucson is one of those places, just outside of Tucson, is one of those places that has the least occurrence of, just because of the mathematics and the geometry, right outside of Tucson is one of the places where there's the least occurrence of totality in the world. And I thought that was a very interesting thing. Here we're in an astronomy capital of the world, and we have one of the least, you know, you have to be in the right circular thing around the Earth in order to be in the place where the moon lines up directly with the Sun. And I found that to be an interesting thing. So, and the other interesting thing is that the Earth is in a situation where the moon is 400 times smaller than the Sun, but the Sun is 400 times farther away. So it matches perfectly for optical illusion that you get. So I'm going to ask you a question. Bill asked this question this morning. When you were looking at the eclipse with the glasses on, you see a little dime in the air, the mylar, you look through and you see the dime and you see the moon going over the Sun and you're seeing this. And then at the moment of totality, you get to take your glasses off and look up. And then all of a sudden that little dot of a 10 all of a sudden becomes a big giant beach ball. What is it because you're looking through the mylar that creates that optical illusion that it's just a little thing when you're looking through the glasses, but when you see it naked eye, it looks like it's this big giant thing? And is that just is it because you're looking through the mylar?
Yes, that, and also because the Sun also has a feature that we call the corona, where really high energy beams are flowing out of the Sun, and that also, you know, creates the light that we see.
Right. And isn't it true that that when the light comes off of the Sun, so if we walked outside right now and looked at the back of our hand and saw our hand because the light's shining off of it, that beam of light that came to us, first off, took 8 minutes to get to us from the Sun, but yet that photon that hit us might have been bouncing around in the middle of the Sun for millions of years. And the fact that we're seeing it at this time and place today, bouncing off the moon or bouncing off the back of our hand, is amazing to me. That photon could have been bouncing around inside the gaseous giant star and then leaks out so I can see the back of my hand. Amazing.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, with studying light and the history of light, because in addition to the photons that we get from the Sun, the photons that we get from the stars, especially if they're far away, could have been formed when the universe formed.
Right. And that's a long time ago. Yeah. Well, congratulations to you on your doctorate. Congratulations on your new appointment at a fantastic employer here, Economic Development. Plug for Raytheon. You're now employed out at Raytheon. Matt used to work there as well. So what a great place for you to land. But still interested in the moon and still interested in planetary science. I'm sure you'll be contributing to the body of science over the next few years. So thank you for being with us this morning. Sixto, thank you for jumping in. Thank you, Bill, for being here. Tomorrow we have General Ted Maxwell. Wednesday, Lydia Ronda will be here. Thursday, Tom Moulton, and I'll be back on Friday. If you'd like to be interviewed on Jump in Tucson, the Friday show, then and share your success story, go to jumpintucson.com and let us know a little bit about you. And who knows, maybe you'll be interviewed live on the air. This is Tucson's only live local news talk station, KVOI, 1030 AM, The Voice. Thanks for listening to Jump in Tucson, and have a great week.